You're listening to The Bouquet Toss, the podcast that helps you plan your day your way by helping you figure out what to keep and what to toss from your wedding day plans. Welcome back to The Bouquet Toss. This season, we are both posing and attempting to answer the question, why weddings? If we're going for a really simple answer, a wedding is a ceremony planned to formally execute and celebrate a legally binding marriage contract between two parties. I know I sounded like almost snooty saying that, and it might not be the sexiest or the most romantic way to describe it, but at the crux of it all, a marriage is a legal contract, and the wedding is like the ritual that marks this life-altering change.
Even though weddings are incredible and magical and often described as the best day of someone's life, there's just no escaping the fact that a wedding is accompanied by several legal considerations, both in your union and in the planning of the event itself.
Yeah, and the legal stuff can be really overwhelming, from getting your marriage license to the contracts with your vendors or insurance. So there's a lot of things to look out for that you got to make sure you're covered by. That's why today we have an amazing guest with us to help us understand all of it, Kunbi Odubagin, who is an amazing business attorney, speaker, digital media expert. She has over 12 years experience in the creative and legal industries. She's the founder of two online businesses, a digital media platform focused on highlighting celebratory moments of life, and an e-commerce store offering legally sound, attorney-drafted contract templates for entrepreneurs, event professionals, and creative business owners like Jessica Bishop. So welcome, Kunbi. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. And of course, I'm going to say great job on pronouncing my name because that's always a pleasure when I hear it.
I'm so glad.
Yes. Well, Kunbi has a super unique perspective about legal aspects of weddings and events because of the intersection of her two businesses and her, you know, time in the industry. So we're super excited to have you.
Yeah. So I think we're going to go through all the things like pre-wedding and then the event itself and then after the wedding. But before we even get to that, I would love, Kunbi, for you to just kind of tell us a little bit about the work that you've done in both of these businesses and kind of like what you feel about weddings and the legal aspects of it.
In 2012, I was planning my wedding and started blogging about it. Anybody that was online at that time knows how, like, you know, it was all about blogs and like documenting your every single moment, not on TikTok, but online in like long spiels. So that's how I got into this space. And that's where my wedding blog started from. It's now called Perfette, which means a perfect fit. And it's basically just the whole story of planning the wedding, like things that I wanted to find helpful, especially as for me as a Black woman who was looking to plan a luxury wedding outside of my original country. I'm originally Nigerian. So that's how the dream started. And so planning the whole process from the beginning was just, you know, like sharing that information and helpful tips and things like that. And all this I was doing while being a new lawyer, navigating the whole experience of starting out as an attorney, basically that experience. I was living two parallel lives. One was a nice, sweet escape from like the trials of law. But that's how I found myself in this space. Now, over 10 years later, I still practice law. I just can't shake it. So I'm a full-time attorney. And as of this month, I just recently sold my blog. Like my what was a blog has become a whole media company has now just like been offloaded. So that's exactly how I was here, navigating being an engaged person and then a newlywed. And then an attorney to so many wedding vendors. I found myself in that unique space, understanding what they would look for in a contract. What a couple would want to look for in a contract as well. So it was just a nice space to be in, toggling both sides. And now we're here.
Yeah, it's so great. We connected, obviously, through the blogging world. Gosh, yes. Probably 10 years ago now. It's wild. It was definitely a different era of the internet at that time, to your point. Like, TikTok wasn't a thing. I don't even know. Like, Pinterest maybe was just getting started at that time.
Instagram had just like came on like a couple of years after we had started blogging. So we navigated that fresh space and just like took advantage of, you know, the no algorithm algorithm was the perfect time. But, you know, we're here now.
Yes, here we are. And now you've really gotten to, like, marry, you know, pun intended, these two aspects of your life together. So we're excited to get some of your advice and insight for our listeners about things to think about and look out for from a legal perspective while they're planning their wedding.
Sounds good. It's always a pleasure. I feel like now I have a particular superpower now, just being able to speak on some of these. So it's always exciting to talk shop with this conversation. So let's go.
Amazing. Let's do it. So if we think about sort of in like a chronological timeline, and correct me if there's anything else I even missed before this, but probably the two big legal things before the actual event, the actual wedding, are a prenup and getting your marriage license. So, you know, where prenups are concerned, we have an episode actually that I think everybody should go back and listen to. We spoke with the women at Hello Prenup, who basically make it easy to get a prenuptial agreement online. But I think it's helpful to hear why a prenuptial agreement is such an important thing, but also, like, if you are going about getting one, what does that timeline look like? When should you do that? What do you need to be able to do that?
Okay, so this is a great question. I feel like a lot of people think that you have to have a certain amount of money for a prenup to be, like, you know, useful or something. But I think a prenuptial agreement in general is a good way to go into things. I'll say especially if there's an income imbalance, but not even necessarily then, to be honest. Especially if you own businesses or have certain assets outside of the marriage. It's like before the marriage has started. Like, it's really important for the couple to be able to understand what happens if something doesn't go right, or like if something naturally changes. The thing that I find in this space specifically, and rightfully so, is that such a happy moment, and people just have like blinders on when it comes to, you know, the conversation around, oh, it's happily ever after. Yes, but it's happily ever after, but like, you know, there is a but, and nobody wants to be the bearer of bad news, right? But a more prepared person then doesn't have to have that stress. A personal friend of mine is going through a separation and divorce now. And the first thing she said to me was, oh, I should have gotten a prenup. Because the way it's like everything is devolving, especially when you have kids, it makes an already horrible situation 10 times worse. I think that one of the things that I say even to clients, like for contracts, well, like regular contracts, is make sure that when you are in your clearest mind, you're thinking about protecting yourself. You're thinking about future you as well. Both parties now have to protect their best interests moving forward into the marriage. So making sure that you have enough time to have that discussion. So like have that be done 30 days before the ink runs dry. Some people will say even 2 weeks. Some people, like, I mean, there's no hard and fast rule here, but execution and filing is super important, and making sure that both sides have executed that agreement. Making sure that you have enough time to actually properly investigate. I hate that I'm using all these big, like, criminal minds words, but the truth is you still have to vet both sides. It sounds crazy, but really, like, it's very important stuff. Somebody could be coming in with like hundreds of thousands of debt, and now you're assuming all that liability because you decided to merge lives with this person. Making it clear that that's not going to be the case is important. So it's not even just about like how much money are you going to give me. It's about like who's going to handle these things that you brought into the marriage, and writing those things down and making sure like you're both clear-minded. What happens if this marriage devolves based on infidelity? What are the things that we prioritize in the marriage that are like amplifiers? What is the thing that's really going to set me off? Like, if I find out that, like, this is what happened. And, like, making sure that that's well documented, making sure that both sides have counsel. You don't want a situation where somebody says they had an unfair advantage, or, like, somebody said that there was unfairness in some way because they didn't have informed knowledge of what they were signing. So getting all of those things out in the beginning will save you so much. I want to throw in a little plug for premarital counseling too, because it's during this period that not even like on a religious basis or anything like that, but even with like a psychologist or whatever, like it's just really important for both sides to know what is going to be the deal breaker for you, so that your attorney doesn't have to be your therapist midway through it when you're trying to stab each other, you know, just those things.
So many good points. Yeah.
Yeah. We did do an episode on premarital counseling, and we could definitely visit that again. Like, it, yes, we totally are proponents for that. And I do, like, I know you said this, but I just feel like it bears repetition of some sort. Yes, people do feel like that it's this magical time, it's romantic, and like the talks of a prenup are kind of a damper on that. But like, you can't really even think that way, because then you're kind of just ignoring the whole fact of like the whole what you're doing. Mm-hmm. Like, what mm-hmm. you're actually doing is saying, I'm legally going to be recognized in partnership with this person. We're filing taxes together. Like, yeah. you're recognized by the state as a union. Yes, there's like this beautiful, romantic, emotional, amazing thing about finding your person, declaring in front of all the people you love that you're gonna mm-hmm. spend your lives together. But like, the real nuts and bolts of it is that you're legally binding yourself to this person.
I completely agree with you. I think that we should think about it this way. A marriage is even harder to get out of. Like, anything that's harder to get out of than a legal partnership, like a business corporation or an entity, it's not something you should play with. It's not something you should take for granted. So why do we look at it as a softer situation? Honestly, I'm a dramatic lawyer. The legal shackles of this situation are like much stronger. So I agree with you. You just have to go with it with a clear mind, like open hearts for sure. But it's also it's a legally binding partnership. So make sure that you're doing yourself that service of protecting it.
Absolutely. So, okay, now that hopefully, you know, we've gotten a prenup, it's time to get our marriage license. Mm-hmm. So I feel like it's probably straightforward, but what does this piece of paper, this marriage license that you're getting, like, what does that do and what does it represent?
So what the license basically represents here is that you've sought permission, one, two, like you, it's basically, I want to give it an example, like compared to like a driver's license where it's given you permission now to actually legally drive is what the whole idea of a marriage license is. Two, it's now giving you that legal right to legally marry and then legally marry under someone that is legally permitted and like accredited to marry. So the license is just one stop. The license to marry is a license to proceed with a marriage. It doesn't automatically mean you're married. So people have sought licenses and haven't actually followed through with a marriage. So that's the way you should think about it. It's just one step. It's something that is saying you're submitting to the court and attesting basically to the court that you are not currently married. You are permitted to enter into a legally binding marriage with another person. It differs across the states in terms of what you can do. For instance, in New York, there's a 24-hour hold in terms of after when you can marry. So making sure that you get that information in, like you both go there, fill out the application robustly. And so that also, like, you have this step in there that shows a recorded, like you've gone through the recorded process to get married. Make sure like that, especially for people that, you know, are planning elopements or are planning like more spontaneous marriages, that you've actually done the work of searching your state's website to find out what the process is to seek a marriage certificate.
So just to be clear, it's a mm-hmm. license in the state in which you're getting married yes. versus the mm-hmm. state that you live in.
Okay, yes, exactly that. Thank you for stating that, because you seek that license in the state where you're married. One thing about laws in most states here is that the states usually carry a lot of the legal power, and usually laws pertain, unless it's like a federal or countrywide law, pertain to the state that you're carrying out that activity. In some cases, it's the state in which you reside, but when you're conducting a marriage in a particular state, you seek that license to marry in that state. So you can't just grab a license from here and then go there.
Right. Okay. And then do they expire? Like, if you get a license, do you have to get married using that license within a certain amount of time?
Yes, you do. So like I said, it differs from state to state. Some licenses can expire really fast for us. It could be 7 days, it could be 10, it could be 3 in some states. But typically you would find that a license to marry might fall into a 30-day window. And then after that, you might have to seek another one because a lot can change. A lot can change in terms of laws and restrictions depending on the window. So typically it would be a certain amount of time in which you would have to marry by.
Got it. And then I don't know, like, this seems like a silly question that I actually have no idea how this works, but what then happens when you actually get married? What are you signing and sending back? Like, what is that process?
depending on the state, again, like depending on the mm-hmm. state, sometimes they will have you sign something, like whoever the officiant is, for instance, will sign and record, also put in their information to let them know that they were the person that carried out this legal marriage. And then you return that to the court as the filing. Sometimes the officiant might be the one that does it, depending on where you're doing it. For instance, if you're doing it in a court, it's quite easy after that because they're already in that space and they will do the filing. But that's the next step after. The whole idea here is that you've carried out that thing that you sought the license for, because the court doesn't know that that has happened after they have given you the license. If there's need for witnesses, those witnesses are also endorsed on the document, and then you return it and file it to the court. That also needs to be done within the time frame, within whatever time frame the state specifies, that it needs to be done after the marriage. So you don't want to keep that going and then say you forgot to record this marriage. That right. marriage still needs to be recorded like every other legal relationship.
Is it the same document as the license that you received?
Most of the time, they will okay. give you a copy of that. And so that person will then sign it and then put it in there. Or sometimes they will attach something called a marriage certificate, in which that becomes the certificate, and then you record that.
Got it.
Well, that was all stuff before the actual yes. wedding day. But when it comes to planning the big day itself, there's also so many different factors to consider. So mm-hmm. let's try to get into some of that, like liability, insurance, permits, vendor contracts. Like, there's so much here to go over. So yeah, where do we want to start?
I would say let's start with general liability stuff. I think for a lot of people, this ends up getting covered by the venue. But if you're doing a non-traditional venue, you know, maybe you're doing it in your backyard or somewhere, you won't necessarily already have, like, these vendors have their insurance set up. They do this all the time, but maybe you're not doing this at a traditional place. So, like, what do you even have to think about in terms of general liability?
Okay, so with a lot of vendor agreements, including the venues, yes, the venue will it's not even guaranteed, may assume certain liability here and there, not necessarily because of like culpability or anything like that. In some states, a venue might have a situation that does lead for them being liable. But you want to be clear and make sure that in your contract, it's clear who handles it, because most venues will require that you have insurance and name the venue as an insured party in that insurance. And then they will put the amount of money inside it. So that's something to bear in mind. You are still the person, you, the couple, are still the person hosting, the person inviting, the person that has brought people together. So you want to make sure that it's clear what you are liable for. Because even in your vendor agreements, dare I say, rightfully so, depending on what the vendor is, in your vendor agreements, you will find that sometimes you will be assuming liability or saying that you will step in to defend the vendor from certain things that happen with your guests. So anybody that the venue, for instance, doesn't have control over, then it might be limited liability in terms of what they are liable for. So then it kind of could fall on you. The possibility is there. This is the reason why it's really important to read your vendor contracts. I find that a lot of people will skim through some of these things because it's like, whoa, this is too much legal, I'm out. But you don't, like, this is a serious situation. There's money on the line, but there's also, like yeah. you have mentioned, liability on the line. So making sure that you read, you understand and know what part you're playing. Especially, I'm telling you, insurance is probably one of the most important things that you can have for a wedding day, even day of insurance, for instance. So exploring what insurance options you can get, and if it's going to be cheaper on the front end in terms of like maybe $100 or $200 compared to, like, God forbid, a whole lot of like various lawsuits. Especially since we're shifting into a more litigious environment, I feel like people are getting sued more often. You just want to make sure that you're protected.
I think it must feel pretty overwhelming for any couple who's never mm-hmm. planned an event of this scale or size before. Mm-hmm. When you're looking at vendors and like getting these contracts back, to your point, it's all this very formal legalese, mm-hmm. legal language, you know? And so if there were like certain clauses or keywords for couples to kind of look out for in some of these vendor contracts, like, could you share some examples of those?
Yes. I think for sure, questions around payment, questions around retainer. non-refundable retainer. What's honestly, from the beginning, I will search the word non-refundable and see what that is. I think one thing that happens with couples a lot, having been like, you know, an attorney for a lot of vendors, I think one of the things that happens with couples a lot is that they actually don't understand their contracts. This is not in a critical way per se. I feel like this about everybody. If you don't understand it, for God's sake, please do not sign it. Please. Like, it's the tiniest thing now. Only God knows what you're giving people in exchange for your sanity and for your money. And maybe for your freedom, who knows?
Yeah, I mean, this is not like the Apple terms and conditions that are so long mm-hmm. that nobody reads them. Although we all should be reading those
because, Lord,
yeah, it's so bad. They get away with so much because of that. They're long by design, definitely. I think to your point, like, if you don't understand it, don't sign it, but also ask. Like, mm-hmm. make sure at the end of the day, you are giving this place a lot of money. So it is your prerogative to take as long as you need to ask as many questions as you have to so that you understand exactly what you are signing, what you are saying you understand, and what potential consequences could be, any of that.
I agree. So definitely I mentioned the payment thing, but one of the very important things that you need to get into is checking and making sure that the language around rescheduling, cancellation, because in the spirit of prenups, in the spirit of marriage license, like we said, stuff happens, things change. So you want to make sure that you understand what the parameters around changing are. If you get money back, if you do not get money back, if you owe money, obviously if you cancel a wedding on the day of, there are going to be consequences because a lot of things have already been paid and already, like, you know, everybody's already in play. Then you start looking for words and legalese that you might not like necessarily know completely, but liability should be a word that should be constantly searched within an agreement. You want to make sure that you're searching words like indemnification, one of my favorite words to see there, because it's just a bunch of letters. And even as an attorney, sometimes the definition gets really stressful. But in an indemnification agreement, somebody, it might not be you, it might be the vendor, but somebody is saying that they will step in and protect the other person or step in and hold that person harmless if something happens. So those are the what I like to call the when things go wrong clauses, but they're there for a reason. Words like force majeure, which is basically a fancy word for like a surprising force. So it actually means major force, but basically saying that something has happened that has now created a situation where one of the parties can't at this point move forward with the contract. What does force majeure look like? What is a force majeure? Both parties should agree on what that is. Like, what is considered something like an act of God, things like that. Death in the family, like whatever it is that's actually an unexpected, unpredictable situation that renders the contract unable to go forward for one party at that moment needs to be documented. Because those are the things that are going to come up. Those are the clauses that typically will be triggered in many conversations. Also, a clause about default. When are you or when is the vendor in default of the agreement? Which is basically like, when is there a possibility that somebody could be in breach? For instance, if you don't make a payment on time, if the vendor goes unresponsive for an extended period of time, things like that, you want to make sure that they are addressed so that you feel comfortable moving forward. And also so that you kind of have a playbook as to how to proceed if any of these things go wrong.
Oh my God, for someone with anxiety, this is not good, but also like, thank you.
The eyes are just getting bigger, like deer in the headlights. Yeah. Okay.
I'm really very good at coming up with the least likely to happen scenarios in any situation.
Okay.
But you kind of do need to consider those. Like, I really hate to even bring it up. It's so sad. But like, God forbid something happens to a family member or someone or one of you and the wedding day comes, like, and you don't want to go through with it, you probably have to. And you need to just understand, you know, when you sign what you're signing, what's going to happen.
And not everybody keeps expecting people to react in a particular way about your personal situation. And that's not how life works. The truth is that maybe, yes, some people will, say, oh, I understand completely and this is what it is. And then some other people are going to be like, okay, yeah, but then I also, like, obviously, I still have overhead to make. I still have to make payments to all these people. So this is the terms and this is how we'll proceed. So making sure that that is clear. There's even another situation that came up in my head where, like, maybe one party is pulling out of the wedding. But now both names are on the agreement, and now both names, like, you know, somebody's liable for the balance. So this is the reason why you have those conversations that we were talking about in the beginning.
Yeah. So I feel like these wedding vendors, they're all aware of what could possibly happen. And so they're putting in these contracts, like the CYA thing for them. Mm-hmm. So really, like, your best, or really maybe only line of defense, aside from knowing exactly what you're signing, is wedding insurance.
Yeah.
And even then, like, it's not maybe not even possible to get everything back or not have to owe things. But I would like to talk a little bit about, like, what's involved there. And I also want to just say, it is very easy to get wedding insurance, and often very, very affordable. Wherever you get your home insurance or your renter's insurance, which, by the way, if you're listening and you're renting and you don't have renter's insurance, here's your reminder to have renter's insurance. Everyone needs that sometimes. But it's not hard to find. It's often very affordable. And take the floor, Kunbi. Tell me about wedding insurance.
Okay, so this is a good one. And actually, Jess and I were in a conference last month, and I think we met, like, so many, there's just so many insurance companies that are, like, you know, even just catering to the wedding space. Dude, there's somebody for everybody, like, for every situation. But, like, wedding insurance is, in my opinion, is there to fill a gap, especially when, like, everything else, like, you know, for instance, if other things fail, it might be the first course of action in certain situations. It might be the last course of action in others. Insurance will cover around many things. There's things, so many things to consider. In many states, liquor liability might fall on the host. It might fall on the person that's providing that liquor, especially when it comes to your guests. For instance, yes, you might have to get, like, someone that's insured in terms of, like, a bar service, or, like, whoever is providing the drinks. The venue might tell you that maybe they do provide liquor liability coverage, but you want to make sure that you're clear about that, because liquor liability might be something you want to tag in your wedding insurance. Wedding insurance could also protect you, for instance, if somebody gets injured. Like, if one of your guests gets injured during the event, and it's something where there's no clear path, or, like, you know, you're tagged into, you know, liability in terms of, like, a lawsuit. You mentioned in the beginning, for instance, if you're hosting on a private venue, if you're hosting on your own private space, or you're the one that's even bringing on those people, there is no reason why you should be proceeding in any kind of situation like that without some kind of insurance in play. No, none at all. Because now you're assuming the role of so many other things that businesses that would already have those benchmarks in place. You are now assuming that role. So you want to make sure that you have those legal protections too. Wedding insurance might also help you, for instance, for refunds, for money that you have expended that now you can't get back, for instance, especially wedding day cancellation. Like, this is obviously the most, like, five-year-old explanation that I have just given you. But this is the reason why you speak with your insurance broker. See, I know, like, wedding day insurance can be as cheap as, don't quote me, but I think it can be as cheap as even, like, $70 or even less for some people. So, like, just make sure you're searching.
It depends on, I know, because I looked it up for myself, but it depends on, like, the amount of money being spent. Like, often there's, like, tiers for how much coverage you're looking for based on the amount of money you're trying to cover. And so it can be very, very affordable. Mm-hmm. And I probably know the answer, and you're going to say it varies state to state, but is there a timeline in which it's too late to get insurance? Obviously, you need it before the wedding. But before you sign contracts, like, when does it need to be in place?
It might not necessarily have to be before you sign contracts, because sometimes you might not even know the dates for certain, like, things yet.
Right.
I will say that for sure, it does vary state to state. And as an attorney, I'm going to tell you it depends. But, like, definitely, depending on the insurance company, they might want to know what vendors you're contracting for. Like, it might also help you in terms of determining how much coverage you're looking for. But some insurance companies will even still take people at least maybe, let's say, 72 hours before. Insurance is not it's not an automatic purchase and it's done, but it definitely has to be before the event. So you want to give yourself enough time. Once things are in play, call your insurance company.
Got it. And I just want to clarify too, when you say cancellations, that could be on both sides. Like, that's not just the party throwers.
Yeah. No,
like,
no,
you could have a vendor that cancels or doesn't show up. Like,
or
we
a venue
hear these
that goes out of business. Like,
oh,
that
God
has happened several times now. Well, several is a reach, but I've seen that a few times over the last couple of years.
Yeah, I know there was a big one in California, like burned down, and I think it impacted a lot of different couples. You, like, you just never know.
Yeah.
So having those protections in place seems like super important.
Yeah, especially like think about it's something you're planning usually around a year out. Mm-hmm. So much can happen.
I mean, we all just lived through a pandemic, right? So hello, that's pandemic. Like the biggest example ever. And I know that that was like the crux of a lot of vendors updating their contracts with more clearly defining what is included in those force majeure clauses, right, Kumbi?
Mm-hmm. Yes. The reason why clauses like the force majeure are there is because of things like that. For instance, if something like an act of God, act of man, whatever, depending on what it is, happens and it's covered in your force majeure, or like a pandemic forces a state closure in which it's now illegal for you to have weddings over a particular site, it's literally out of both hands at that point. And then you, like, you know, you seek what you can. But these are the things that insurance, for instance, the venue going belly up or the venue burning down is something that insurance, for instance, might be able to cover. So those are the things. Like, I know everybody gets tired of people saying this, but like, if you're going to ever read anything in this world or understand anything, it's probably your contracts and what your insurance provides. Because you find like, even with homes, like people that got their houses flooded, for instance, and then found out that their insurance did not cover a flood, especially since like your reflex would tell you that that's probably what's going to cover, and you find out that it doesn't, there can't be anything more heartbreaking and helpless about that situation after it's happened.
And definitely since COVID, there's a lot of venues that have created their own insurance kind of policies to cover them. So like, I know I saw a few venues where if you had to cancel because of state restrictions of not allowing big gatherings, like similar to what we had with COVID in the past, that you could reschedule, like, you know, it was like maybe I think $600 was like the insurance. And then by paying that, you guarantee that you can reschedule for another date within the next calendar year and still have your wedding there at like no additional charge beyond that. So, you know, but not every venue is doing that. But yeah, I mean, that was definitely like a cool thing to see because...
Yeah, that's very thoughtful.
Yeah. I mean, these businesses in the wedding industry especially went through it. And everyone probably learned the hard way.
I think that was a collective learning experience for everybody. Like Jess mentioned, like we all went through it in some way or the other. So while it does give you like, you know, empathy and everything like that, I think for everybody involved, it's really important to just move forward with like with your eyes wide open and like with your like knowing you're looking out for your best interests when reviewing the agreement so that everybody's happy and everybody's aware as to what's going to happen.
At the end of the day, the purpose of having contracts and insurance is to give you peace of mind to move forward with like confidence and like security and like be able to enjoy your day without worrying about all of this stuff. So I think this has been like such an important conversation.
So, okay, keep moving along the timeline. So now you've made sure that every single vendor you're using in any capacity at all, you have signed a contract with. And you, before you signed it, you understood what you were signing. So then the event happens, right? And you don't forget to sign your marriage license if you need to sign it and send it back anywhere. Is there anything else in terms of like closing the loop with your vendors or like a post follow-up you should think about?
Yes. Also, definitely make sure that you have some kind of cancellation termination agreement there. So you're closing the loop. So everybody's clear that nobody owes anything and that nobody's going to sue anybody. And just to remove any kind of miscommunication for the photography, if the photographer needs to give you like a photo use license or like an agreement for you to use it in a particular way, make sure that you're getting all of that. Videography, even maybe the planner have other things that might like may have other things or other duties that might occur after the actual event has taken place. So making sure that you're not in breach, you're answering their questions, like you're doing your part so that there are no issues. And also just make sure you pay all your bills, because that is gets really awkward when like you don't want to get into collections or bring in debt into the new marriage. When you can just clean this and keep that tidy, make sure you do still keep filed copies of your executed agreements, because like I said, not every agreement, for instance, might end on the wedding day in terms of like deliverables or things. And also that way you can refer back to that if there's anything that you want to discuss with the vendor, and also keeping records, for instance, of your receipts and things like that in case there's anything that you would need, especially for tax purposes. Like also because unfortunately liability is not necessarily an end all on that day. If somebody comes back and says that something happened on your wedding day and they want to now start making it a whole thing, you want to be able to go back and see who's liable, how this conversation happens, and also just know what your next steps are. This is the legal part of getting married, but really mostly it's the legal part about like, you know, throwing an event or hosting an event.
Yep. Whew, okay. We got here. We got to this point.
Right here.
Now, the next thing is changing your name if you want to, and updating your will or your estate plans. So I want to start with changing your name because I actually see this question often in like brides Facebook groups, because there is a confusion I think that happens when people are like, okay, I signed my marriage certificate with my maiden name, but I want to then change my legal name. And some people will be like, if I don't have proof of residency in this state, like, do I need a new license before I can then even change? Like, there's just a whole bunch of things that I think can sometimes happen concurrently. And your name changing is like such a huge thing. So can you, I guess, just enlighten us a little bit about what goes into name changing and when it needs to happen or doesn't or whatever.
So, I mean, this question is so open-ended because I'm going to start with the first thing. It depends. So it depends. That is the legal thing for, okay, so it's state specific. It really is state specific. So you want to make sure that you're doing that. It goes in different forms. For instance, I can speak on New York, for instance. New York, you need to file on something with the Department of, God, don't quote me, but it's DOMCH, is it whatever, health records, basically. And you need to file a form, but then you also now need to seek a name change with the court. In New Jersey, for instance, because my friend just finished that, she had to say her name in open court where she changed her name legally from her maiden name to her official name. A lot of people will tell you that you have the legal right to your new name without having to do much. But that is not the case, though, if you want them to be changed, for instance, with your social security, if you want it to be changed with your passport and things like that. So my first step, I would say, is going and contacting your local state court, finding out what the process is, first of all, in your county as to how you can change your name, like legally name change. And then it will tell you the process. In some states, I believe some states still do the procedure of actually publishing your name change in like newspapers or in journals or things like that. That's how, like, it could go. It's very varied is what I'm getting at. They're probably going to ask for your very important document now, that marriage certificate. And then showing that that's the legal right to the name. I will tell you that typically what it would be is that there has to be a court aspect to it in terms of like a certificate. I'm going to give you a random example. I naturalized as a U.S. citizen in December, and I did go to court for the naturalization just to like swear in or whatever. And when they were done, they attached a court affidavit, basically a court decree to my attachment saying that my name had legally changed to my surname. This is, yes, I know, this is 11 years after my marriage, but that's not the point. I have not changed my name because it was stressful, but this is basically, you get what I'm saying. There's a court aspect to it. So you want to make sure that it's something that you're clear as to, do I have to appear in person? Do I have to say it in open court, like that my name is changed? Or is it something as simple as me just filling out a form? And then that way, once you have that court decree or the court ordered name change, basically, or whatever proof or approval of that name changes, then you can take it to the IRS and start making all those other changes. Like Hello Prenup, there are so many companies that will help you with a name change. So choose peace and choose ease when you're doing it so that you don't get overwhelmed.
We have a few listed on our website. We can include some in the show notes. Yeah.
Yeah. Sure. So I know we can get help with these places, like to know exactly how to do it. But when it actually happens, I feel like I should know this, but like, where else is the court making that change? Like, how is it stored? Do they reissue you a new license?
That's a great point. So first of all, you need your current license to be able to do this usually, because it's going to be identity verification of your, like, whatever your previous name was. Once that is done, the court does their own part in terms of, like, just filing it. It's literally just their order. Now you have the grunt work to do. You may have to book an appointment with the IRS for your social security card. Long story short, nobody's sending out to anyone, typically, unless you're using a service. You will still have to do that part of, like, you know, making sure that you're updating your records everywhere.
Hence why you waited 11 years, because it's so much to do.
Well, as soon
it
as
is
I
truly so much.
The torment of having to go to the Nigerian consulate in New York. So I was already like, it's not really worth it to me anymore. I'm just going to keep this name. And then also for me, I have a license to practice in New York, Pennsylvania, and Washington, right. D.C. I wasn't about to start doing this. I was just like, okay, I'm good. So, and even now I have that court decree. Have I done anything with it? No, that's the big question. So long story short, I have two names.
Do as she says, not as she does, right?
Do as she says, not listen.
Awesome. And so finally, I think the last thing is updating your will and your estate plans.
Yes.
And, you know, I think this is something that, again, you often don't like discussing. Mm-hmm. Pre-wedding, but it is so important to do before. And I think for a lot of people, obviously not everyone, but for a lot of people, they don't like have a reason to have an estate plan or a will before they're married. Like mm-hmm. they often don't have any dependents, or, you know, if you don't have anything that you're like protecting or anything, like, you don't have a reason really to write up a will that's specific to you. And so this is kind of like that first thing where it's like, well, you've got somebody else that would legally have the right to your debt. That sucks.
Yeah.
But your assets or whatever it is. And you have to then make sure, now that you're married, that you are putting in writing what you want to happen with the things that are yours.
Yes. Just like any other relationship, but now even more than anything, you both are, like, you're one now. We'll insert something super romantic here, but like, you're now one force, you're a team. And so making sure that you're protecting, like, communicating about what the plan is if something happens, especially since, I'm going to say it again, it's very state specific as to how, what happens in the event of a disaster. You want to protect both parties now. So speak to a trusted estate's attorney, or, like, you know, make sure that you at least even just have some kind of form plan down. Things move fast. One, I would expect that, especially with a couple, that maybe one of you are not expecting that, well, somebody's going to pass away or that somebody's going to get incapacitated in some way. You want to make sure that you have power of attorney to be able to, like, you know, make decisions on that person's behalf, access their records if that needs to be done. Otherwise, it just makes, like I said before, it makes a horrible situation worse.
All right. Well, I'm not even going to say that ends on a sad note, because this is all so helpful. And even if you decide that you are like, all right, I'm going to be really proactive and I'm going to learn all these things, it just feels really good to hear someone like you, Kunbi, like, talk about it like you're our best friend and you're just telling us, hey, girl, this is what you got to know.
Yep.
So thank you. Thank you so much. Before we go, do you want to just kind of share with our listeners where they can find you, like, on the web or anything like that?
Yes, thank you. So I am one half of a business law firm for creatives and entrepreneurs and event pros. So we know what we're talking about when it comes to this industry, called Oduberg. So you can find us on oduberg.com. We're all side hustlers now. We all have creative businesses. So if you want, like, a ready-made contract template, maybe you can afford, like, an hourly fee for an attorney, but want a really solid legal agreement that you can download and purchase, created by attorneys, we have a contract shop called Legally Set. So visit legallyset.com. And then you can find me personally at KunbiESQ on Instagram. So check out all of those things. And just hit me up if you have any questions, because I've been yelling at you for like an hour or so. So if you have any questions, just feel free to hit me up on Instagram at KunbiESQ, or check out Oduberg and Legally Set online.
Amazing. Thank you so much. It was so great to talk to you today. Yeah.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for being here, listeners. And it's just been such a pleasure having you.
You've been listening to The Bouquet Toss, brought to you by thebudgetsavvybride.com. For more tips, tricks, hacks, inspiration, and support, check out the links in our show notes. We are a proud member of the Evergreen Podcast Network. Get more information and check out other shows in the network by visiting evergreenpodcasts.com.
Ever heard of Stoicism? Chances are, if you have, you've heard of Stoicism with a lowercase s and not Stoicism with an uppercase s. Lone wolves, no emotions, antisocial behavior, cold indifference. All that is Stoicism with a lowercase s. Stoicism with an uppercase s is the ancient Greek philosophy and virtue ethics framework that centers on service to the cosmopolis, to include your family, friends, community, and planet, and the development of a good moral character. My name is Tanner Campbell, and I'm the host of Practical Stoicism, a 3 times a week podcast teaching Stoic principles and concepts to anyone interested through the exploration of texts and deep dives into various moral topics. You can find Practical Stoicism where you're already listening to podcasts by searching for Practical Stoicism or by going to stoicismpod.com. I invite you to give it a listen today. You just might like it.